This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah, nasta'inuhu wa nastaghfiruhu wa nastahdihi. Wa na'udhu billahi min shururi anfusina wa sayyiati a'malina. Man yahdihillahu fala mudilla lahu wa man yudlil fala hadiya lahu. وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله صلى الله عليه وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي وقيني شر نفسي وفارق لساني وإن أعطيت غدًا أغدرت غدًا بغير حق رب العالمين وبعد السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. First of all, I want to thank Sister Lisa and everyone else who's responsible for affording me this opportunity to come here and to share with you some of my thoughts and feelings and to benefit from the intellectual, the spiritual, and the practical capital that's in the room. I think that we are in a very unique moment in our history as a Muslim community in America, and it really does behoove us to not only take advantage of, but to try to create as many forums that will afford us the opportunity to come together and to share the kind of capital that we can bring to bear on this situation. I think that for far too long we have been siloed, we have been sort of mutually alienated, and we have not sort of found that rhythm that we could all move to together, as a result of which we have not been able to achieve all that we can achieve or take advantage of all the opportunities that we have before us. And I'm going to talk about that, I hope, in a very unique manner tonight. I'm someone who, although from extremely humble background, I have had the pleasure and the luxury, indeed, of traveling to many countries around the world, including the Muslim world. And it never fails to impress itself upon me what an enormous opportunity we have here as an American community if we would just recognize that opportunity, recognize what it takes to take advantage of it, and operationalize all that we have to move forward. So I'm going to be talking about tonight the miracle of Islam in Black America. And I'm going to start off by trying to preface this, because I don't think that we are quite used to thinking about the emergence and the rise of Islam in Black America in terms of a miracle. And I think that we need to come to some understanding as to why that is. Many of my students over the last number of years have been used to hearing me make this statement, and that is that defeat is a disaster. And defeat is a disaster primarily because it leaves the one who has been defeated with the sense that he or she can only retrieve their sense of dignity and reestablish their place in the world if they are able to do to the one who conquered them what the conqueror did to them. That becomes their sort of marching order. Even more importantly, this sense of defeat can imbue the defeated one with a sense that the most effective way to reverse those fortunes is to adopt the ways, the tools, the thinking, the priorities, and indeed the sensibilities of the conqueror. Now, this is routinely disguised. Vanquished people don't tend to say, "I'm going to adopt the ways of the victor." It tends to be disguised in a thousand different ways. So much so that oftentimes those who present themselves as the most ardent opponents of the conqueror can turn out to be precisely those who are most firmly in the conqueror's grip. Most firmly in his grip. Now, from my perspective as a Muslim, the clearest and most damning manifestation of this defeat, disguised as religious commitment, resides in the loss of one's vertical gaze. I'm an academic, so you'll pardon me, but I'm gonna try to break it down so that down the road. But what I mean by vertical gaze, I mean we lose our ability to look up. And our gaze is exclusively and consistently projected out. We look out at the adversary. We look out at our enemy. We look out at all those things that we want to achieve in life. And because we are only looking out, we only recognize worldly ways of achieving what it is that we want to achieve. We recognize worldly ways of visiting upon the conqueror what the conqueror visited upon us. But here we have to ask the question, in this particular moment, if all you recognize are worldly ways, whether you recognize it or not, in fact, whether you admit it or not, you are still in the grip of the conqueror. Because he, the dominant civilization in the world today, has set the worldly ways through which you're going to try to achieve your aims and your ambitions. And if all you recognize are those ways and those mechanisms, you are a follower, and he still is the leader. This is the way it is. And part of the challenge is how you arrive at a point when you can see something beyond the material ways of the world as a means of accessing that which is most precious in you, that which is the highest expression of yourself, that which takes you into a universe of values and meanings that enable you to achieve a modicum of independence from that conqueror. And this is where it becomes important to recognize the value of that vertical gaze. And by vertical gaze, I mean, again, the ability to go beyond just this and to be able to do that, to look up to Allah, to look up to that ultimate power. And to believe that that ultimate power has the ability to bring about miracles. And if you don't have that, and by the way, I want to be very clear here. We are in the world.
But we ain't nothing.
There is no Archimedean point. You can't get outside the world. I'm not talking about looking up in order to float up and away from the world. I'm talking about opening up your being.
Go away.
And letting that divine strength, that divine guidance, that universe of divine values and sentiments, have those accompany you in the world that will enable you to see things in the world that you otherwise might not even be able to see. Because if you are limited to the material mechanisms that have been crafted by those who have conquered you, huh? you will never be able to transcend that order toward anything else. This is what I mean by the importance of a vertical gaze. What has happened to so many of us, we've been reduced to entirely horizontal people. That's all we do. We just look out. Even in the way we deal with each other. Even in the way that we deal with our spouses and our children. You really think that you can be a good enough parent that you can guarantee your child's success as a Muslim? Do you really think that? You alone? Do you really honestly think that? If you do, you are a fool. Even after you have done all you can do, you need God's guidance. You pray that Allah guide your children, that He protect your children, and even under circumstances that don't look like they're quite gonna make it, because you are attached to Allah, you know that miracles can happen. And once you are reduced to the point where you no longer can believe that, He got you. Because you can't go beyond the world that He created. This is the reality. And I know this kind of talk, you know, it doesn't sit right with so many of us. And we're living in a moment where it is extremely difficult to engage in constructive self-analysis and criticism. And part of what makes that so difficult is that you know that there are those out there who want to do nothing but use that against you. Right? And yet, that's precisely what you must do if you are to improve the kind of person that you are. And if we don't believe that we have been reduced to a vertical gaze, I want to ask you all this, and I don't want anybody, don't raise your hands. I don't want anybody to incriminate themselves. So take this as a rhetorical question. On average, how many times you think today, the average Muslim, either you or those in your circle, the average Muslim, you know, how many times a month do you think they read Quran? Once? Twice? 5 times? What would be a good average? Anybody? Don't lie. Tell the truth. What would be a good average?
5 times a day.
No, no, no. I'm not talking about salat. No. I'm not talking about salat. I'm talking about, again, a vertical gaze. Because that's what you're doing when you read the Quran. When you read the Quran, you're trying to reconnect to that universe of values and meanings that come from outside this world. You're trying to reconnect with what Allah has said, with the divine word. Right? I want to ask ourselves, how come we don't read the Quran? That's why. Anybody follow what I mean by that? That's why. Because we've been reduced to this. Right? And we can't do that anymore. Right? Now I want you to listen to me very carefully. Because part of what can happen if we're not careful is that the world out there can completely paralyze us. Or quietly drive us to insanity. And what do I mean by insanity? I don't mean running around acting crazy, but I mean in the sense of we continue to do the same thing and expect a different result. Think about us communally, collectively. How long we've been doing some of the same things that don't work and expect a different result. Because we don't have the ability to transcend those circumstances, or an attachment to values and meanings that come from Allah Himself. They're all empowered. We need to understand. There's a verse in the Quran where Allah instructs the Prophet himself to say, alayhi salam, say, O Muhammad, I do not control any benefit or any harm that might come to me, except as Allah wills. And if I knew the unseen, me, if I knew the unseen, I would offer nothing but good, and bad would find no way to me. But I am just a bringer of good tidings and a warner to a people who believe. This is the Prophet Muhammad saying what? Every moment of my life, I'm doing what? I'm looking where? I'm looking up. Every moment of my life, because I know I don't have control over what comes my way. And without Allah, I will not be able to surmount the challenges, to take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves to me. My nafs, my soul, my fears, my anxieties will be too big of a barrier between me and what I should do. And only by being able to look up and to attach myself to that power will I be able to navigate this thing here called life. This is the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. A man who always looked up, even when he was looking down. And we know the eyes that he was able to surmount. This is what we have to remind ourselves of. But there's another dimension to this blindly horizontal state of consciousness that I've been talking about. And this is what I want to talk about really tonight. Part of the reason that defeat is such a disaster is that the first thing that it destroys in the defeated is their ability to believe in the miraculous. And this, in a sense, is precisely the aim of the conqueror. Because if he can reduce you to believing in nothing but what you see before you, the odds will always appear to be too great, too large, too insurmountable for you to do anything. As a result of which, you're reduced to a sense of powerlessness. And you end up with a sense of desperation, in which you just go out and do all kinds of things. All kinds of crazy things. It's just desperation. You're not thinking, you're not planning, you're not even invoking principle, but you're just desperate. You gotta do something. Why are you waving at me? That's all right. You gotta do something. All right? But again, you do that something, and you do that something, and you do that something, and what does it produce? And what do? That something, more something, more something, more something. Right? That's one thing that can happen to us when we fail to believe in the miraculous. The other thing is that those challenges become so insurmountable that we just can't beat them, join. You just surrender. You just give in. And sometimes you give in, I mean, you put Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim on the front, right? But you no longer exercise any real agency in the decisions that you make in life. I want to suggest that to an appreciable extent, this is what has happened and continues to happen to us. As a result of which, we have overlooked, and we continue to overlook what can only be characterized as an absolute miracle right here in America. And I believe that as long as we continue to misrecognize this miracle, we will remain off course. And as one of the ancient Muslim sages says, one who has lost his way will never be taken to their destination, no matter how long and how fast they travel. If I'm trying to get to California from here, and I aim my direction south, I can travel forever. I'm never getting where? I'm never getting California, because I'm headed in the wrong direction. And I believe that as long as we continue to misrecognize this miracle, we will remain off course. So let me try to explain what I mean by this miracle. And when I say miracle, I'm not speaking metaphorically, I'm speaking in real terms. Many of the young people in this audience, and I'm talking particularly, and you'll understand why, just relax everybody. I'm talking particularly about the Black American young people in this audience who were born to a Muslim mother and a Muslim father. They will take their Islam almost for granted. I mean, this won't seem like a big deal for them, right? Muslim. Yeah. And partly because that's all they've ever known. You understand what I mean by that? They're not like us, not like me, right? We're what? What? We're converts.
Reverts.
Okay. Reverts. However you want to phrase it, all right? But it was a more conscious break with something else. Everybody follow what I mean by that? For our children, many of them, this is normal. It's all they've ever known, okay? But this is what I want to focus on for a moment. This is not normal.
I'm telling you.
Okay?
It's unusual.
If on the day I was born, and 1911, if on the day that I was born, I see my brother Jimmy Jones back there, he can say something similar. On the day that we were born, Jimmy, you're a little earlier than me. But if someone had come to our Christian parents, someone come to my Christian parents, both of whom grew up poor in the Jim Crow South in the 1920s and 30s, if someone would have told them that little Black child that you're holding on your arms right now is one day going to grow up to be a Muslim. That one day you're going to visit that child's home and you're going to find your granddaughters wearing a hijab, praying in Arabic. If someone had told them that the city they lived in, I'm from Philadelphia originally, would one day be teeming with Muslims. You can't turn a corner without bumping into a Muslim in the city of Philadelphia. If someone had told them that, if someone had told them at some point the most famous human being on the planet would be a Black American Muslim named Muhammad. In fact, if someone had told them that Islam itself would be the second largest religious representation in the entire Black American community, no one around them would have been able to believe that. No one. No one would have seen this coming. I've been a Muslim some 40 years.
I converted when I was three.
But I can tell you, and this is what I want us to understand, I knew no Muslims growing up as a child. I knew no Muslims growing up as a child. This is a phenomenon that largely takes place in my lifetime.
And so now we have what? We have brothers, we have sisters, we have cousins, we have aunts. There's hardly a city you can go in America today where there's not a contingent of Black American Muslims. How did this happen? And I know that there are many in here who will tend to see this as just a continuation from Africa through our slave experience. Let me share a little factoid with you. Upwards of 10 times the number of Africans that were brought to America as slaves went to Brazil alone. Somebody understand that? Went to Brazil alone. Do you see any Black Salafi movement in Brazil? Do you see a Nation of Islam movement in Brazil? Do you see a Muhammad Ali in Brazil? Do you see a Malcolm in Brazil? Do you see anything like you see in terms of the phenomenon of Islam in Black America anywhere in the Western Hemisphere? Anywhere. Do we recognize this? And how? Someone came and conquered Black Americans? The gunboats on coming off the Atlantic? An entirely volunteer situation produces this groundswelling of Islam in the Black American community. Right? And when we look at this carefully, we'll see not only is there something unique about this, but there's something, and hold on, because a lot of us get a little upset here, but there's something uniquely American about this. See, this, they came out with a report a couple days ago. Many of you may have heard about this. They said that Black Americans are like 20% of Muslims in America. Of course, that number is depressed, all right? And this is not just propaganda, all right? I mean, we know the number is depressed because, right, somebody like me probably wasn't included.
Okay.
Why? Why? Say it. Say it!
Because you ain't a real Muslim. You ain't from the Middle East.
Well, tell me what you really think. Right? Sherman Jackson. Right? I mean, I have a Muslim name, but not legally. And we know many, many, many Muslims who have a Muslim name, but not legally. All the, probably, maybe a majority. All Jimmy Jones. Muslim? I don't think so. According to the, you see what I'm saying? So those numbers are depressed. All right? So let's bump them up, what? 5 points? Would that be? Even 20%. Let's keep it at 20%. You have nothing like this anywhere else in the entire Western world. Do you understand that? The overwhelming majority of Muslims in a place like England are immigrants. Not from the native population. You can say the same thing about France, the same thing about Germany, the same thing about Italy, the entire Western world. There's only one major Western democracy, all right, in which between the first and second largest contingent are native-born peoples of their country, and that is this community, the Black American Muslim community. That's how unique this is. It happened only here. And one of the questions, a number of questions, we need to begin to ask ourselves is why? If we want to begin to recognize the miraculous nature of what we're dealing with here, if we can look up for a minute and remember, لَا حَوْلَ وَلَا قُوْتَ إِلَّا بِاللَّهِ. Nothing happens in this creation without Allah's permission. Nothing. So this can't be an accident. But ask yourself this. Why did Islam in America come to Black America? Why not Latinos?
Why not the dominant group of whites? What specificities reside in the fact that Islam came to, in the majority, the Black American community? And this is not a nationalistic platform. We'll get to that in a bit. But we need to understand this. Why Black Americans?
We the lost and found people.
Why Black Americans here in America? Why Black people who are the very conscience of this country? The Black American community. The one community that can constantly remind America, just by its very existence, of the fact that no matter how powerful, how rich, how influential America may become, it can never deny the fact that it remains capable of great evil. That community is the conscience of America. That community is the community to which Islam comes. Why does Islam come to that community in America that has never been associated with any kind of domination or conquest? Do you realize how important that is? So when the Black American community goes out and speaks and represents Islam, people don't see them as an attempt to dominate. You don't get this sense that I'm not going to surrender to them, because that community has not been associated with conquest and domination. And yet, this is the community to which Islam comes in America. What is the sort of Islamophobic rhetoric full of today? Fear that these Muslims are going to do what? Conquer and dominate. And yet Islam comes to that community in America that has never been known for what? Conquering and dominating. What are the dawah potentials of that? Why does Islam come to that group of Americans? The only group of Americans for whom protest is accepted as a part of an authentic identity. You understand what I mean by that? You don't understand what I mean by that? Okay. You see, Black Americans, he gave me some of his time, so relax. Didn't you?
Yeah, I gave him some time.
He gave me 15 minutes.
I'll wrap up.
But I want to make this clear. You see, everybody thinks that the greatest slur, not everybody, many people think that the greatest slur you can direct toward a Black American is the N-word. That's not true, right? In point of fact, I come back to the East Coast and my Philly sense. In fact, the N-word can be used as a term of endearment by the right people. But there's one phrase that can never mean anything but something negative to a Black American, and that's Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom. Is there any other group in America even that has such a category? Black Americans are authentic to the extent that they resist the unwarranted imposition of anything upon them. And they are inauthentic to the extent that they don't. The only group of Americans are like that. And Islam comes to them. You talk about the necessity of speaking truth to power or even truth to pain. This is the group that is more likely to do that. Because protest and resistance is a part of their authentic identity. And this is the group to whom Islam comes to in America. This is an accident? Why does Islam now come to that group in America who are the leaders par excellence in the production of one of the most seductive exports that America has? And that isn't popular culture.
Who are the champions of popular culture in America today? And have been for a couple centuries. Who? Why did Islam come to that people? You begin to get a picture here? And by the way, and I want to say this, and I ask a lot of God in my heart and God in my tongue, because we've been misled for some time. And many of us as scholars have been party to that misleading, because we've allowed our community to fall into the understanding that sheikhs, imams, and scholars are the only ones who have anything to do with our future. And we put everything in them. Let me tell you something, all right? The plausibility structure, is that too? I need to break that down. The plaza what? See, can I break it down? See, here's what you gotta imagine. And work with me, okay? Y'all not. Y'all gonna work with me?
Yes, all right.
Now, just imagine this. I drew a 9 right there. Everybody see that? Everybody got that 9?
Yep.
All right. Now, if you look at that 9, okay? All right? You'll see a 9, right? No, look, no trick questions. I don't play trick questions. Amen. Even at the university, I don't play trick questions.
Amen.
All right? If I ask you what this is, it's a 9, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if I put an E and an O right there, what does that 9 become?
G.
See that? That's plausibility structure. It's the things around the 9 that enable you to recognize it as a 9 or not a 9. And the 9 itself can't defend its 9-ness. No. You understand what I'm trying to say? So if we, you don't understand what I'm trying to say?
Say it one more time.
Say it one more time.
Do it again.
Do it again.
I got
it. Do it again. All right. You got a 9, right?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
And I say, what's that?
Nine.
So 9. Right? Then I take an E and an O. And I put them on either side. Right? And now you see, wait a minute. That says ego. Therefore, that 9 is no longer a 9. It's what?
G.
It's a G. All right? And here's what we need to understand. Let's assume that that 9 is all of the teachings of Islam, all the teachings of Sharia and everything else. All right? All right? That's the 9. All right? We cannot preserve the integrity of that 9 if we can't control what goes on either side of it. You understand what I mean by that? That's culture. You understand what I'm talking about? Okay? There was a time, I remember one morning, I was in the airport, going somewhere. And I was hungry, so I stopped at one of those Burger Kings in the airport, Detroit airport, I still remember. I wanted to get me one of those egg and cheese breakfast sandwiches, right? So I got in line, and there was a gentleman in front of me, black American gentleman, all right, who was a Christian. And how did I know he was a Christian? Had a nice crucifix, you know, one of those, you know what I mean? Right, the bulging ones. He's a Christian, okay? The woman came out and dumped a bunch of sandwiches into the bins. This man in front of me said what? He said, excuse me, miss, what's that? Don't tell me it's no swine. I ain't no swine. What's wrong with that picture? What's wrong with that? What's wrong with him eating pork as a Christian? What changed the value of his eating pork as a Christian? The cultural production of groups like the Nation of Islam. That's a fact. And by the way, I was never a member of the nation. I'm Sunni day one. But facts are facts. And we cannot ever be ashamed or unwilling to recognize facts. As the law says, stand up for the truth, even against yourselves. All right? That's the plausibility structure. You can, with that E there and that over there, you can double down and triple down, and I don't care how many times you do the not, it's still gonna be what? Still gonna be a G. Right? Our children are suffering more culturally than they are religiously. When they fade away from Islam, it's not about I don't believe in God no more. I don't believe in Muhammad no more. I don't have a cultural plausibility structure in which I can be cool and Muslim.
Think over that. Think over that.
You hear what I'm talking about? All right? Well, I can be a gangster Muslim. I don't know, whatever. No, I'm serious. That's real. That's real. And so since I can't reconcile this, and what I'm saying is that what is going to reinstate many of the values of Islam is the cultural production from people like people in this room who are not scholars like me. And you need to understand your role in that regard. That nine will be important until the day of judgment. That nine representing what? Religious teachings. That will be important to the day of judgment. What stature it enjoys, that will depend on a whole lot of things that don't necessarily have anything to do with the nine. And this is where we have to become a community, really. And we have to recognize the role that all of our community members have to play. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Who's going to make it cool to be a Muslim? The Hafiz Quran? Right? Did you understand the point that I'm talking? I've been studying this stuff my entire whole adult life. I'm not deprecating the tradition at all. All right? Okay? But the tradition itself recognizes the fact. Look, you have Abu Hanifa, you have Imam Mahdi, you have the Ghazali, you have Ibn Taymiyyah, you have all of them. All right? How was Islam able to sustain itself in the world? They had to fight wars, did they not? Oh, I see you in that moment. You're watching the DC, you can't say war. That was the way of the world. I mean, Europe fought wars. I mean, let's get real. Okay? Did they have to defend? I mean, they had to. Okay. Did they have to face the Crusaders?
Yes.
That makes you feel better? We can justify it now, right? They had to face the Crusaders, no? Okay. Who planned the battles?
Allah is the best
planner. Yes, but the asbab, the means, right? I can say Allah is the best of planners, but I can't expect no children if I ain't gonna get busy with my wife.
And then
right? Who planned those battles? Huh? I can't hear you.
The generals.
The sheikhs? The generals. Who designed the weapons?
The women.
Are you beginning to get my point? Civilization is sustained by more than religious scholars. And we need to understand that. And I don't say this as a blanket criticism of the scholars. I say this in an effort to get you to stop letting yourself off the hook. Because you have a role to play as well. And the scholar's role in part is to keep the boundaries as broad as we can legitimately keep them and allow you to do your thing within those boundaries. So that we can become a community again. All right? To recognize the nine for a nine. This is what's happening now. Many of the debates that we are having in the Muslim community now, I could not have imagined 25 years ago. You follow what I mean by that? That's the power of cultural development. Especially when you're in a position where you have no cultural authority. And yet, Islam comes to that community in America who are the champions of cultural production. Who could have planned this? No, I mean this very seriously.
Allah.
Who could the black community itself have planned this? Who could have planned this? When you really start thinking about this, and thinking about it seriously, and you're able to look up and allow that to inform your business, you may be able to see something akin to what Allah describes with the mother of Moses. Throw him in the basket and throw him in the water and let it flow. To be picked up by whom? The most powerful man on the planet. Why Islam in the black American community in America? The most powerful, the wealthiest, the most influential country on the planet. This is all an accident? But you see, part of the reason we can't see this is because we don't care about no miracles. We want what? We want to deal with him. You understand what I'm talking about? We want to stick it to him. We want to stick it to them. Rub their face in it. See, that's like that. So we can't see any miracles. Would you absorb in that? Right? And because we can't see the miracle, we do not allow ourselves to invest in this miracle. Because if we see this as a miracle, then we have to see ourselves as part of a miracle. I'm a Muslim. I mean, as I said, not in her wildest dreams could my mother have imagined that her son would grow up to be a Muslim. And you multiply this by millions in America. And yet it happened. Now, and it wasn't easy. I still remember, some of you maybe remember this too. Because see, the conversion wasn't something, it wasn't a walk in the park. I remember still vividly today, it was an Islamic center in Philadelphia on Broad Street. A brother was teaching me a brand new Muslim. I mean, as the Egyptians say, give me then, a brand new Muslim. And he was teaching me how to make wudu. And then he said, and then you take some up your nose. I said, up my nose? No. That's how strange it was. You follow what I'm talking about? That's how strange it was. I remember, you know, fasting the first Ramadan in August. I got headaches, man. I ain't never seen no headaches like that. Ever. And that was after day one. And I tell myself, I got 28, 29 more of these days to come. But guess what? We did it. Some of the sisters, do you remember the first time you put on hijab? Walking down the street, you go out the house with your hijab, you come back. Didn't it fall off your head? Right? The first time you walk into your job, into your classroom with hijab. The stairs, the this, the that. And yet, we did it. We did it. Here, in America. Who could have predicted that? This is what we have to get back to. We have to recognize the miracle that this is. And we have to invest in this miracle. And we have to understand we have a responsibility to take care of this miracle. And this miracle is what will give us a sense of mission. This is what we lack now. This is why we're so individualistic in all our dealings. We got no sense of mission. Because when we have a sense of mission, we understand that we can't achieve the mission alone. We need to be brothers and sisters. And a real man. We don't have time for pettiness. We don't have time for ego. We don't have time for self-pity. We don't have time for all that stuff. We don't have time to be scared. Because we see ourselves as being connected to something that's greater than all of us as individuals. And that will inform the way I deal with you, even when I disagree with you. You look at the way some of us tear each other apart today. Over whatever. He said this, he did that. Right? And I'm not arguing that we should not address each other about what needs to be addressed. But if we have a sense of mission, then we understand I have to address this brother or this sister in a manner that deals with the issue at hand, but that also does not take him out or her out of the play as part of the mission, because we need them all. Does anybody understand what I'm trying to say here? This is what happens when we can begin to recognize this miracle that we have, all right? Because you need to be imbued with a sense of mission. Many of us don't have a sense of mission. That's why we can't sacrifice anything, including our own opinion. I remember once, many years ago, I was teaching in the University of Texas, and there was a Saudi sheikh. All right. Got two more points I want to make, that's it. There was a Saudi sheikh who came to town, and some of the brothers were talking about another brother who had arrived in town, how he was a great brother, they had all these accolades about him. I remember distinctly, the sheikh asked the following question. He said, because he spoke no English, I don't think he did. He said, Hada, huh? Sahab al-Halim, am sahab al-Risala? Lenna sahab al-Risala aqwa min sahab al-Halim. He said, this person, are they a person of knowledge or a person with a mission? Because the person with a mission is more effective than the person of knowledge alone. Even if we can't be sheikhs, even if we can't be scholars, all of us can and must be people of mission. We have to have a sense of mission. Without a sense of mission, we can't sacrifice. Without a sense of mission, we can't be charitable. Without a sense of mission, we can't even be courageous. We'll always rationalize ourselves into the safe thing to do, because we don't have a sense of mission. And all of this is partly because we cannot recognize the miracle of Islam in Black America. Now, that they're pressing me on time, I want to make two last really important points. Too bad, because I got to make this. See, it's not part of the reason that we don't recognize the miracle of Islam in Black America, huh? Is that there are many people who don't want to allow us to recognize that miracle. Because there are many people for whom, if their racial and their ethnic group is not the center, they don't want to recognize it. But understand what I mean by that? We've been disabused in part of the ability to recognize it. All right? But I want to say to you this. All of us recognize a miracle that happened 1,400 years ago, do we not? And not only him, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, but what? In some sense, more importantly, what? Say it. All those people around him. If Allah could bring about a miracle,
in 7th century Arabia through pagan, mushrik, idol-worshipping pagan Arabs. A miracle that changed the world. And we, no matter Daisy, black, white, mixed, we all recognize this miracle. Because it's our miracle. If Allah can bring about a miracle to the Arabs in 7th century Arabia, why can't he do the same thing with black Americans in 20th and 21st century America? Why not? And why can't you recognize that? And why can't you recognize that? And you recognize that? I've said it before. Bani Hashim was the clan of the Prophet. But all of the Muslims, Omar from Bani Adi, Uthman from Bani Abd Shams, all of them benefited from the protection that Bani Hashim offered to the Prophet and the Muslims. So even if you're not black, this is your miracle too, if you're a Muslim. And this takes me to the point that I really want to make. This is not some warm, over sophisticated call to some kind of black nationalism. And I'm not saying all this stuff that I've been saying just because I'm black. I'm saying this because I'm a Muslim who recognizes divine providence for what it is. And one of the things we have to be real careful about, especially in America, because this is what America breeds. It breeds primary identities. That trump religion. No pun intended. Does anybody understand what I mean by that?
Yes.
All right? Let me give you an example. White Americans at the founding of this country, they identified whiteness as a primary identity, as the apex identity. And once that happened, Christianity couldn't do anything with it. American nationalism couldn't do anything with it. American patriotism couldn't do anything with it. All right? Whiteness was the identity that separated white from non-white. It was the apex identity. We have to be very careful that we don't fall into the same trap. Some of us as black Americans, we do the same thing. We adopt the black identity as our primary identity, all right? And then we expect Islam to what? To support that black identity and never challenge it. We use our blackness to domesticate Islam instead of Islam to domesticate our blackness. We always write as white as black people. Oh, y'all don't meet me out there like that.
Yes.
No. Yes. We're always right?
Come on.
Yes. See what I'm saying? We're always right? We never make any mistakes? We never make any wrong turns?
Is you black? No.
And what's gonna correct that? Some of us act like, as long as we down with the dominant black culture, then whatever infractions we have, Allah can't really be all that upset with them. Because we down with the dominant black culture. No, that's where blackness becomes an apex identity. All right? Now, I want to say, I'm a black man in America. I got no intention of being nothing else but a black man in America. But my primary identity is Muslim. My primary identity is Muslim. My values, what I see as right, wrong, are going to be informed by the fact that I'm a Muslim responsible before Allah. And that's why no matter who you are, I can write, this is right, that's wrong. And with that, we can become an empowered community. And by the way, black folks ain't going to lose it. Some of our women do the same thing. We don't have time for playing games. We don't have time. No, we don't have time. Go ahead. No, really, we don't have time. I am sensitive to all the issues that our women have to confront. All the issues, all the disappointments, all the pain, right? All of the dismissal,
addresses as Muslims. We can't say, I'm a woman, and what Islam has to do is support everything I want and don't want, all right? It does my bidding, I don't do it. Do you understand what I'm talking about? And the beauty of it is that we can address those issues as Muslims. This is what we have to understand. We cannot allow ourselves to fall into these primary identities, all right, in which we want Islam to follow rather than me. Islam has to be our iman. Islam has to be our leader. And that's why my sister and I, we can come together and we can agree or disagree. And she's going to say, no. Aisha, whole books have been written on Aisha. Okay? All right? Remember Suyuti. And this is an abridgment. Kitab al-Isaba, Fima Astadrakatu Aisha tu ala Sahaba. A book in which Aisha corrected the male Sahaba so many times. No, wrong. Why? Because she's a woman? Because she knew what the Prophet taught. And what the Sahaba said? We're not accepting this, because you're a woman. They said what? Oh. Oh, he said that? Oh, my bad. No, I'm very serious about this. You know what I'm saying? There's a problem we have. And we've been socialized more and more and more to make the problem worse. All right, last thing I want to say. I want to say something to America. No, this is important. I want to say something to America. Especially the dominant group of white Americans. I want to say two things. First, I would advise America to be smart. What do I mean by be smart? If America is smart, it will recognize that in the black American Muslim community, it is sitting on a gold mine. The entire Western world is pulling out its hair, trying to figure out how can Muslims become an organic, integral part of these societies. The entire Western world, that's all we hear. Way back in 2001, I think it was, they asked a group of black leaders gathered in a church in Philadelphia, what can we do to make Muslims feel like they're more a part of us? The Reverend Al Sharpton said, what? Whoa, what are you talking about? There's not a person in this church who ain't got a brother, a cousin, an uncle, a father, a mother, a sister, someone close to their family who's not a Muslim. So they're already a part of us. Do you see that, America? We have Christian parents, America. Many of us have Christian brothers, Christian sisters, atheists maybe. We don't have that problem. We can show you, all right, what a healthy integration, a healthy indigenization. And notice I did not say assimilation, because you only assimilate into a society that you don't belong to. This is mine. I'm not assimilating to my own. I indigenize, all right? We can teach you that this can be done. You need to understand the value of this black American Muslim community. And then finally, I want to say this. We intend to pool our resources, to unite, organize, to educate ourselves, and to acquire enough power and influence to be able to defend our interests right here in America. We're not going to run from power. We're not going to hide and then imagine that somebody else is going to take care of us for us. We're going to pursue the ability to take care of ourselves. But this is what you have to understand about us. And maybe I'm just speaking for me, so I'll say this. You can agree if you want. I'm right, but. You see, we have been instructed by our prophet. Okay? We know
Even Muslims ain't always right. We know that. And this is why our prophet taught us what? Unzur akhaka, zaliman aw mazluman. Help your brother, whether he is right or wrong. They asked him, O Rasulullah, we understand that we should help our brother if he is right. But how can we help our brother if he is wrong? And the prophet said, what? You stop him from doing that wrong. This is who we are as Muslims. This is who we are as Muslims. American, black American Muslims, who are as interested in the common good as anyone else, but a common good that is negotiated with us at the negotiating table. Not a common good that you decide that we must assimilate into. JazakAllah khair. I apologize for going over time. I just wanted to be clear. And Ubaydullah told me he didn't want to take a whole lot of time anyway. So JazakAllah khair.